Thanks for coming along, guys, to this Young Actuaries Program session on how to pass your exams. Michael Zhao, please. Our presenters today are Bruce Thompson and Gary Musgrave. So Bruce, he's a self-employed consultant who works in wealth management, funeral funds, and valuation of some unusual assets. He's been an exam marker, a course tutor, and he's currently the chief examiner of CAP. Now, Gary, on the other hand, has extensive experience as a valuation actuary. He's been an exam marker, staff actuary for 2B, assistant examiner and chief examiner for 2A, and currently he's the chief examiner for 2B, and he's also the chair of the board of examiners. So you're in good hands today. Now, over the next hour, Bruce is going to talk about exam preparation and organisation, whilst Gary will talk about tackling an actual exam question, which is that sheet of paper on your chairs. They're happy to answer specific questions as they go along, or otherwise field your more general queries or comments afterwards. And please note, we have a roving mic today because the session is being taped, so if you do have a question, just wait for Nick up the back there to come to you with the mic. And finally, I've been warned to warn you that you should believe anything at your own peril. As you'll soon find out, some of the comments will be quite personal and don't reflect the views of the Actuaries Institute. So without further ado, I give you Bruce Thompson.
Thank you, Gary. Hi, all. You've heard actuaries get bagged along the lines of if you ask a question of two actuaries, you'll get three answers. Well, Gary and I today are aiming to be even worse than that. We're aiming to give you a whole lot more than three answers, and it's up to you to decide which of those answers applies to you, because not all of them will, or if all of them apply to you, then you're probably starting from a very low base. I'm hoping that an awful lot of what you hear today you will have heard before. Some of it you will reject as, hey, that doesn't apply to me, that's fine. Maybe some of it you'll say, hey, maybe I'd better do this a little bit more than I have in the past, or pay a bit more attention to it. If you're the sort of person who's been passing every exam, then the door's there, you're probably wasting your time here today. Actually, yes, Gary's right. You can provide tips when we finish and provide additional. In fact, Gary and I will shorten our talk and you can come out here. What I'm assuming, though, is that we're mainly talking to human beings who struggle to pass actuarial exams, even though they may have sailed through school and or university beforehand. They're finding it's a bit harder now. So hopefully that's what we're going to help you with a little bit here today. I'm going to talk about motivation, about getting background information to help you in your studies and in your career. I'm going to talk about study plans and discipline. Somewhere in there I'm going to talk about actually doing the work of study. Although my background is English speaking, I want to make a couple of comments about if you struggle with English or that's not your background, or if you're more a mathematician than a writing words type person. And finally, probably introducing to Gary's talk, I'm going to talk a bit about your approach to the exam in general. But first, I want to talk about motivation. And I'm going to start by talking about fear, or if you like, negative motivation. You know, how much do you fear failing an actuarial exam? Maybe you don't fear it enough. And so I figure with a topic like that, I'm very unlikely to get a volunteer from amongst you. So Lisa and I put the random number generator earlier onto the list of registrations, and hopefully the person who we have chosen to be our volunteer is here, and I'll tell you in a minute who that is, because we're going to ask somebody to come and stand up on this chair and sing a song. You're all doing the maths of, hey, there's 50 people in the room, what's the probability it's me? I'm hoping it's not me. How much do you hope it's not you? Do you fear that more than how much you would fear passing an actuarial exam? Possibly not. But it gets worse, because this is going to be recorded and put on YouTube. And in order to make sure that we get a lot of people watching a singing actuary on YouTube, you're going to be naked. No, I'm kidding, of course. Thank goodness they all say. But just for a second there, were you starting to think, whoa, I really hope this isn't me. I really fear Bruce's chair, singing, YouTube, etc. I don't want this to be me. I want you to think of that in the same way as you think, I don't want this to be me failing an exam. Would you fear singing naked on a chair more than you feared failing an exam? If the Institute said, we will give you a free subject pass in return for coming out the front here, now maybe you'd start to think about it. I don't want you to do too much thinking about it. Negative motivation's not necessarily the way to go. Kerry thought of a way earlier on when we were talking on the phone yesterday about a great way of making a substantial reduction in the course fees for actuarial courses. After the results are out, all the people who fail are going to be taken out into Martin Place, put in some medieval stocks with a big sign above them saying failed actuaries, and the Institute's going to sell eggs and rotten tomatoes to all the accountants who are walking past as a great fundraiser to get the fees down for the courses. Would that motivate you more? Would you study harder if that was the outcome of failing? The trouble is, failing is sort of almost normal around this profession. You come out of uni and then you fail a few subjects, yawn, yawn, yeah, everybody does it, yeah, okay, I'm just trying to fit in with everybody else and be a normal actuary. If you pass every time, it's almost rude. Don't give yourself an easy out. Don't say, hey, look, doesn't matter if I fail this one, I'll go again next time. Get yourself some self-respect, or build that self-respect into your thinking while you're studying. Enough on the negatives. Positive motivation is probably what works much better for most people, and I do not want to be responsible for YouTube events at the end of this semester, please. Young actuaries and young actuarial people get rewarded with money. Hey, you've passed a subject, here's your pay rise. Hey, you've passed a subject, we'll give you a different job and push you through. Pass enough subjects and you get a car. Does this motivate you? Probably not very well, is my answer. Because you're probably paid more than most of your friends already. Your non-actuarial friends. Sorry, assuming you've got one. You're probably paid above average weekly earnings. You might be paid more than one or both of your parents. Right? Money may not be a great motivator for you. Well, how do you make money a motivator for you? This is not investment advice, but go out and buy an overpriced property in the Australian market. Get a big mortgage and see how much money motivates you then. So you might go broke, but hey, you'll pass some exams. What's more important to you? My point is, I don't think money is a great motivator. Don't tell that to your boss, and I promise I won't either. Okay, so what sort of rewards would motivate you to pass an exam? And where I'm leading is, I think you've got to arrange that reward yourself. The institute's not going to do it. Your boss isn't going to do it. You need to come up with something that will motivate you. A holiday to somewhere, or, I don't know, a new skateboard. Whatever is going to motivate you. Something that you wouldn't have otherwise. And if money is not the biggest motivator, then you can afford to spend a bit of cash on whatever it is that would motivate you. Engage other people. The people who pass most frequently are married people. They've got somebody in their ear because they're not studying at night. Jolly well pass, right? I want you to hurry up and finish these exams because I want you to re-emerge into the human race. Right? The partner, be it male or female, sorry, non-actuarial partner, there's another piece of advice, is a great way of getting you motivated. And it doesn't have to be a marriage partner. It can be a mate or something or other. And, hey, we will go on this kayak tour to Antarctica together if I pass my exam. Now let's see them get on your shoulder to make sure, how are you going, Bruce? Are you studying? What are you doing at the pub with me? Get home. Engaging other people helps a lot. A study mentor, maybe. Somebody. We talk about mentors for your career. Why not have a study mentor? You probably don't want to call them that, or they'll think that you're a twit. But somebody who is going to help you with your motivation, who knows where you're at and can follow through and give you a few helping hands as required, and if a little bit of the negative motivation is required occasionally, well, maybe they're there for you to do that too. Might be your mother, right? On the phone, have you been studying? I don't know. What works for you? And my point here, don't underestimate the power of these sort of incentives. I'm probably talking to a room full of people who are like me, who are techos, technical sort of people, good at maths, that's why I did the degree to start with. I've got a technical sort of job, and we tend to underestimate the power of salesmanship and all these emotional sort of things. But they will still work on you if you can get the right incentive, the right motivation. Any questions? At least I've got your pulse going, have I? You're all thankful that you're not singing.
Choir?
Yes, a massed actuarial choir. Background. The trouble is, it's too easy to focus on chapter 3 is all about such and such, that's what I need to know. Well, this is not to say that you don't need to know what's in chapter 3, but the problem is I think you need to know more than what's in the textbook and in the course of reading. This means you have to not just read the Australian Financial Review. That's what other techos read. You should be reading the daily newspaper's finance column. And Frederica is writing in and saying, hey, I've got $20,000 to invest and I'm on the pension, what should I do? And the poor sod who's answering the column has got to come up with some answer for her. Now, I'm not saying you should read this every day from cover to cover, but get yourself into consumer mindset, because they are the people who are buying the products that you are providing or that you are designing. They are the people who you have to please. They are the people whose reasonable policyholder expectations you have to have awareness of when you're giving an exam question. More breadth in your knowledge, in your background, in your experience, than what you will get from the Institute course. That one non-actuarial friend you had before, well, get them to introduce you to their friends. You need to talk to non-actuaries. You need to have lunch with non-actuaries. Don't have lunch with the people you work with. You won't learn much from them. You need to go socialising to the pub or playing sport or something or other with the non-actuarial cricket team or whatever it might be, right? You have to be talking to these people, and somewhere short of industrial espionage, you have to be drawing experiences from them, in response for which giving them an interesting discussion of your actuarial day if they so choose. If you're in a larger company, ask for the senior actuaries or senior people to do presentations for the actuarial students. Right? When the financial condition report's been completed, it's a great time for the actuary or actuaries that have been involved to present to the students, this is the important things that we've been talking about, these are the issues in our company, and this is how we're recommending that they be solved. It would be wonderful, of course, if you could have a look at the financial condition report of 16 other companies, but unfortunately that's not very likely, unless you go and work for 16 companies. But what you can do is as much as you can within your own company. If you work in a small company, you have the advantage that you probably have a broader exposure to different issues within the company. That's good. If you work in a larger company, what you have to seek is not to get stuck in one job for 2 years in the corner, beavering away, doing an excellent job on that one piece of actuarial technical work. What you have to seek is that you get moved around to some very different places within that one large company. The value of the large company is that you can get those sort of work, those sort of moves. And in getting all this experience, you should be looking several subjects ahead. You don't just read the newspapers looking for general insurance quotes because that's the subject you're doing at the moment, because next year you'll be doing a different subject. Look several subjects ahead. Look several years ahead. Look several roles in your company ahead. Maybe you are looking several company moves ahead. Maybe to different countries looking ahead, right? All of that sort of breadth is directly relevant to an exam question. How often have you seen an exam question that's set in the mythical country of Bidalonia or something or other, right? These mythical countries are usually based on Singapore, Fiji, South Africa or somewhere. If you've got that sort of background around the world, around different countries, around different companies and around different industries, then that's the sort of background that will help you tackle these questions. The questions are not generally, or beyond part A of the question, it's not, please recite pages 3, 4 and 5 of the textbook, right? You know it's not like that. You need more. Why are you studying? Try to answer to pass exam. My answer, it's not good enough. Why are you really studying? My answer, you want to learn and understand the material in breadth, as I just said, in order that you pass an exam, in order that you become a good actuary, in order that, invent your own. Passing the exam is only a way of the Institute measuring that you've done some of this learning and understanding. If you study just to try and pass the exam by the skin of your teeth, you probably won't get onto the become a good actuary step. You will become an actuary, but you won't become a good actuary, and you certainly won't get to the steps beyond, right, if you're barely scraping through. Think of sitting 3A and barely scraping through. What's straight after? Well, 3B. How are you going to pass 3B if you barely know 3A? And what's after 3B? Hey, I want to be a good actuary in general insurance. If I only barely pass 3B, right, see the point? Don't aim just to pass the exam. Aim to kill it. Aim to more than pass it. Aim to really understand the material. If you start aiming at 51%, yeah, you'll pass in a couple of sittings probably with 51%, but you'll never be the good actuary. Aim to kill it. Aim to to do way more than just pass. Aim high. Do the course at least twice. And a cynic would say, if you don't, you'll be forced to, because you'll be back next semester. Anything that you learn other than, or even rote learning, really, you will understand it much better the second time through, because chapter 3, 4 and 5, you can put in the context of chapter 13, 14 and 15. Oh, now I know why they did that. It's because of something I saw later. And it's only when you come back and do it a second time that you start recognising this. SMARTER objectives. If you've done any management courses, SMARTER stands for, it's a mnemonic for objectives that are specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, timed, and agreed. In your study plan, don't just go, oh, I'm going to go and do an hour study tonight. Have an objective. Say, I am going to do such and such tonight in order that I understand X, Y, and Z. And if that takes an hour, that's fine. If it takes 50 minutes, stop work. You've achieved your objective. Well done. Reward yourself. Go out and have a chocolate bar or Easter egg or whatever it is that you reward yourself with. Study groups. Again, breadth of experience. You learn something from the textbook. You might learn something from the textbook. The two of you get together and you talk about it and you realise that you've actually picked up some different things or you've brought different experiences to the table. I think study groups are wildly underused amongst actuarial students. The ones who use them best tend to be the ones in small towns, like London, where there's a small group of people doing one Australian course. They go, oh, look, there's three of us doing life insurance in London. Let's get together and have a study group. And blow me down, they all pass. Whereas you put 30 of you doing the same course in Sydney and you walk through, shrug your shoulders and go, oh, another one. Right? But you don't need 30 in a study group. Three or four or five. Get together with some sort of discipline. Maybe with an agenda. We are going to be talking about such and such. Or Mira is going to be talking about such and such. Oh, look, she's got to prepare something. Oh, isn't that terrible? She might learn it as she prepares it and teaches us. Discipline. Oh, dear. Make specific sacrifices. Believe the failure rate. Don't think that just because your mate has been in the pub until 2 a.m. and then gone down to the exam the next day and passed, don't believe that you can do it too. If you're like that, then you're probably, as I said earlier, not in this room here now. Most people don't do that. Most people need to work harder than they have before. At university, you had a certain number of hours at uni, and the rest of your time was for play and study and doing the odd assignment, and life was pretty cruisy. All of a sudden, you've got a full-time job. All of a sudden, you've got income, and you can spend it on more than a beer in the pub. But, oh, dear, what a waste. I've got to study? Unfortunately, if you don't want to study a lot of times, then you have to study very intensively this time in order to avoid doing the same subject next semester. When I was your age, isolating yourself meant shutting the door. YouTube, Facebook, iPhones, all of this just didn't exist. If you're going to isolate yourself, it really means becoming antisocial. And your friends have to realise that you are antisocial because you want to be an actuary. And them's the breaks. Use blocks of time. Have an objective for that block of time. Say, righto, I'm isolating myself. If 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. works for you, then hey, that's good. Or midnight to 2 a.m. works for you. It doesn't matter what it is, but set aside the block of time and go, here's my objective for this. I'm going to jolly well do it. I'm going to turn off the TV and all the rest. If you can't discipline yourself to study, you will find yourself studying more hours in the long run. Doing the work. Write summary notes. Most people learn better by writing something down than they do learn by reading it. Summary notes are also good because you can come back to them later and quickly remember some key things that you need to know. And in an open book exam, I'd suggest you should be aiming to take into the exam very few things. I use the word aiming because an insurance policy says, yes, yes, everybody, they can tell the actuaries when they're coming in there because they're the ones who bring suitcases. Other people laugh at that, but as an insurance policy, why wouldn't you bring everything in? But you haven't got time to go through and find something when you don't even know where it is, right? You should aim, I suggest, to have a couple of pieces of legislation, a couple of textbooks or something or other, and your study notes. And everything you're going to need is going to be on your study notes, and your study note will probably even tell you that the life prudential standard number such and such is about this issue, and on page 5 you've got it marked or something or other. But your study notes are your key in the exam. With just a few other things, that would be your aim, to only need that in the exam. Why do you need study notes in the exam? It's because you're not expected to rote learn some of these things. As you saw, I've forgotten what life prudential standard LPS 20 is. It doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter to you. You don't have to know that sort of fact. You have to understand it. Once you get it out, you go, ah, yes, that's about this, and I can write about that. That's fine. Don't think that by studying, by doing the rote learning, you're going to pass the course. Don't study to your strengths. It's so easy to work hard on something that you love. It's so hard to take specific time out to work on that analysis of surplus rubbish that's so difficult to understand. Right, that's exactly the thing you need to take the time out to understand. Right, you have to not play to your strengths, you have to go and concentrate on your weaknesses. Sad, isn't it? The online forum is a great way to get the easiest 10% of your total mark, provided you put a little bit of effort into it. The online forum has worked far better this semester than I had expected it to. I was a cynic. I didn't think it was going to be a great idea. I have changed my mind in 2 months. It is a great idea. It is working very well. Thank you to you people, because you people are asking questions, and it takes a little bit of study and intelligence to ask a question. You people are answering questions. You've got to look it up and share your knowledge, and everybody shares from that. And then when somebody answers your question or somebody responds to your contribution, you see that other people think slightly differently to what you do. If you had never contributed, you would never have got that feedback. The formula for the forum, which you probably know, is you've got to make 3 original contributions and then 3 comments on other people's. You should be aiming to do far more than that, particularly the comments on other people's, and 2/3 of the people are doing just that. And this has got to be... I'm a tutor in one of these subjects. I find it very exciting that I'm going to be forced to give a whole lot of people 10 out of 10. What a great start to passing the exam. It's got to be the easiest way of getting 10%. You can do it in your own time. You can get some help. Doesn't matter. Don't waste the practice questions too early in the course. I've seen people in week 2 of the course saying, oh, I was doing last year's exam question number 2 and didn't quite make sense. I think you're wasting it, because even if you come back to it later in the course, you still have wasted it. A big part of the value is the practice of looking at it for the first time and figuring out what this means and how you would go about answering it. And if you can't answer it, well, for goodness sake, go back to the course and have a look, or go back to people and talk, or whatever it may be, so that you could have answered it. Now, of course, that's no good to you, because the same answer's not going to be asked next semester. But that sort of practice of how it goes and filling out your knowledge is what you want to do. And I've got a point there. Figure out how you learn best. We're throwing out a whole lot of ideas. Who knows which ones are going to work best for you. When you find ones that work, suggest them to other people, but make sure it works for you. Work hard on it. If you work 80% capacity, you'll probably fail. And you can work 80% capacity for about four semesters. You might eventually get lucky and sort of have absorbed it all. Right? But four times 80% is the work you've done. Work at 99% in the first semester and you'll probably pass. 99 is a whole lot less than 320. Right? Be lazy. Work hard. If that makes any sense. Right? Work hard right from the start. Don't pretend to yourself that you're sort of taking a... I'll just have a go at the course this time through, but I'll not work all that hard. I'll concentrate it on it fully next semester. Right? Either do the job or give up. Right? Don't go off with a half attempt. You're wasting your time. A lot of people have trouble, and Gary will talk about it with the questions, but if you're meant to understand the material and you are mathematically strong, but English is not your first language or it's just not what you were particularly strong at through your school and your formal training, you need to adjust for that. Acknowledge it's not your strength and say, I'm going to spend more time on the reading. I'm going to take very careful notes. I'm going to cross-check with my peers. And I've said there, except in exams, it's probably frowned upon. But I'm going to cross-check with my study group. I've interpreted this in such and such a way. Is that what you got out of it? And you'll both learn something. Hopefully you're not both wrong or missing out on what it is. But two heads are better than one. And if communication is a weakness of yours, then adjust for it. Make sure that you practice on interpreting questions. What is this question about? Again, Gary will talk about it specifically, but on the practice questions, when you're doing them, before you even worry about how you're going to answer it, what is the point of this question? Why are they asking this question? I've just done this certain course in retirement income streams, and they're asking me this question. How does this question relate to the course? What are the issues here that I'm expected to be able to answer now that I couldn't have answered 6 months ago before I did this course? Get inside the mind of the examiner for the questions. Get inside the mind of the course writers. What is it that you are meant to be learning here? And finally, as you approach the exam, there's a new pass criteria, a 60% scaled mark to pass, but you also have to not seriously misunderstand any question. That's the wording. In the past, if you got two D's, right, a bad fail on a question, if you got two D's, then you'd probably fail the exam. That's no longer the case. But if you get two D's, in fact even one D, then you may be judged to have seriously misunderstood that question. So yes, you've got to get 60% scaled mark. I'll come back to scaling. But one of your objectives is to make sure you've got a coherent answer for every question, that you're not going to get vetoed by any question. Having achieved that, you then have to get 60% of the marks, or a little bit less than that in the exam if you've got 9 or 10 for your forum. You're aiming for 60% of the marks though, right? If you've studied really well and you go through and you like the questions and you do well, do fine, okay, that's easy, right? You'll pass. But let's talk about where you're struggling. And you know that you've done pretty well, but you really struggled with a couple of the questions and you've got 20 minutes to go. Where should you spend the time? In the past, the answer was you should spend the time on the weakest questions because you had to try and avoid two D's, or preferably even one D, right? You had to try and build your questions that were failing questions up towards or into the passing zone. And I think this is the only difference that the new formula introduces, I suspect the best place to spend your last 20 minutes is not on the weakest questions, that is weakest for you. On the weak on the question that you've really struggled with, you've probably written all that you can know, all that you know, all that you think about, all that you can think of. You've probably done that already. On the questions you've got an A for, there probably isn't much more that you can write about. I suggest that you spend your time on the middle questions, the ones where you're roundabout pass mark. You probably know some more about this question if you think carefully. And you can probably get one mark here and one mark there on these middling sort of questions that you might have struggled to get if you'd spent this last time on the questions you're really good at or the questions you're really bad at. You follow the reasoning? I think the new formula says spend your time at the end on the middle questions. In the past it was spend your time at the end on the questions that you've failed. People like allocating 1.8 minutes per mark, if that's the formula for time and marks. It's a good starting point, but I'd suggest you don't do that. I'd suggest you allocate less than that so that you've got time left over and you can spend the time left over to target where you can get some extra marks. Doesn't mean you stop writing in the middle of a question, but don't get too tied up about the 1.8. What order should you do the questions in? And the answer is in order to suit you. Maybe the easiest question first to get you off and running. Maybe that's going to make up some time for you. I wouldn't put the easiest question last, because if you're struggling for time, you're going to miss out on the easy marks that you could have got. Numeric questions, maybe put them last. Numeric questions can be a bit of a trap, because if you go out on a tangent and something's not quite working, you can spend a lot of time getting nowhere. Maybe put the numeric question last if there is one. Leave some line spaces in your answer, not a whole page, but leave spaces so that you can come back and fill in another three lines when you think of something or if you've got some time later. In the CAP course, too many people leave the executive summary not just to last but to long last, and then they cut and paste a few bits from their main part of their report and say, here's my executive summary, and then they wonder why the executive summary is not all that coherent and they end up with a marginal fail. The executive summary is the most important part of your CAP report. Don't scrimp on the time that you take on it. Do a good job on the executive summary. I know it's logical to do it last, but don't plan to be still working on it with 10 minutes to go. I mentioned the scaled mark. I'd almost suggest you don't worry about scaling. Scaling just says if one question's harder than another question and everybody's failing question one and everybody's passing question two, the marks will get scaled up and down respectively, in order that the total 60% be a measure. If you start trying to second guess that too much, I think you'll just waste time in the exam. I think the point remains, if something's easy for you, make sure you don't spend too much time on it writing every last thing that you can possibly think of, because you've been working on that for the last 2 months at work and you probably know more than the examiner, right? If it's worth 5 marks, you're trying to earn marks 6, 7, and 8. You're wasting your time. You've already got your 5 out of 5. Move on. Your life does not depend on passing these exams. You are not going to get pilloried in Martin Place or put on YouTube. Your livelihood does depend on it, though. It is important. Make sure that you motivate yourself or employ other people to motivate you so that you can take the lazy route of passing quickly. Figure out what learning method works for you. But when I say learning method, I mean learning so that you understand it, not so that you can recite it. You need to understand it. Your objective isn't to pass the exam. Your objective is to understand the material. And now you get to understand a question with Gary.
So what do you do when you come to the exam? Okay, you're at the exam. So when examiners look at students' papers, they see these common weaknesses occurring all the time. So if you're going to pass the exam, you really got to say to yourself, have I overcome these weaknesses? Are these my strengths? So particularly the first one, a lack of understanding of basic concepts. You've got to know your stuff. If you don't know your stuff, you're going to struggle to pass the exam. But even if you do know your stuff, students usually fail because they have one or more weaknesses below. So Bruce has talked about how much time you spend on questions. You might spend too much time on a question, and that means you don't give enough focus on all the questions. And this inhibits you getting enough marks on that last question where you might have got a D. So you've got to make sure you allocate your time appropriately, so you answer each question appropriately and fully. Give each question its due requirements. The general comment is people do not read the question properly. They read what they want to see and perhaps answer the question they want to say, but you can't give marks, the examiner can't give marks for a question that wasn't asked. And that's very difficult. And that's where you can lose a lot of marks, by misreading a question. If questions are 3 or 4 marks, usually just the way you lost 3 or 4 marks straight away. So that's very important to read the question. General answers are provided. Students don't relate to the question. So if you say something about reinsurance, you've got to say why reinsurance is important. And that's got to refer to the context of the question. So that's also important. When you raise a point, you need to provide a clear and concise explanation. You've got to explain why it's important, because that's the only way you're going to get a mark for that. The exam is really focusing on judgment in practical situations. 80% of the mark is judgment. So you've got to really be able to handle that and tackle that. Most students will struggle getting past 50% of the complex judgment marks. So that's where you need to practice on the complex judgment part of the exams. That's where you'll get some marks. And the examiner will take that, will think that's a very good thing that you've got, if you're showing judgment in that area. Generally, students can provide, say, the 4 easy points, but they struggle to provide all the other points. Now, the next one is people don't state the bleeding obvious. Don't assume anything. Don't assume that everyone would say that. State the obvious. And there will always be some calculation questions, and I've done exam interviews where some students are scared of calculation questions. I don't know why, but usually, I can only talk from life insurance, but usually we set them so they're simple and straightforward. And what you find is people will stuff it up. So you've got to make sure if you can pass that question, get good marks on that numerical question, that's puts you in a good position to pass that exam question. So you may want to check what you've answered twice. You might want to check it again, that you've done the calculations correctly. So it's important to make sure you get good marks on that calculation question. Now, the other thing is, the examiner's got to be able to read your writing. So you need a technique to be able to write fast and legibly. So you need to practice that. Because examiners do try and read the writing. They try and be generous. But sometimes it's very hard to know what someone's writing, so you can't give marks if someone can't read it. So it's very important that your writing is legible. If it isn't, then you need to practice it so it can become legible. Any questions on that slide? So that's an important thing. When you're doing a trial exam, you've got to say to yourself, are these my strengths? Have I overcome these weaknesses? Okay, what we're going to do is look at a... So you've all got an exam question. before you start looking at it, what are the first things you would do when you first come and see this question in the exam? What do you do first? What are the first couple of things you do? You don't do nothing? Come on. Any suggestions? Don't be afraid to say anything. Yeah?
Look at the number of marks.
Why is that important?
Depends how much time you should spend on that.
Yeah? Okay. What else would you do when you look at the question?
Read the question, those people reading the materials
and the talk. So then just know what they ask in the questions.
Yeah? Also, Bruce covered another idea. You might want to look at all the questions and see which one you want to tackle first. So, if you look at a question, what you'll see is all the information is in the question for a specific reason, right? It is there for a reason because it's going to be used in the answer. And what you find is in the exam drafting process, any relevant material is removed. So all the information is important. Okay, so let's look at this question. How many times should you read this question? You say you have to read it, but you have to do it more than that? What more do you have to do? Is it just reading it? How many times do you read it? Any ideas, suggestions? If you're going to tackle this question, would you read it once, twice? How many times would you read it? You wouldn't read it at all? Come on.
I'd read it twice, and then as you go through the parts, you kind of go back to the question to pick up keywords.
Yeah. Another way of saying that, you could underline keywords. Because it's easy to glance through something and not pick up the important words that stick in your mind that have been asked. So let's look at the first paragraph. What's the important things in that first paragraph? The first paragraph sets the scene for the situation. So what's important in that first paragraph? Okay, you're reading that first paragraph. What's going to click into your mind? What's important about it? Why is it in the question? Why are certain things stated in the question? What's important that you should register in your mind? Now, why you have to say, why is that there in the question? Because usually the question usually doesn't state that, doesn't say it's a new company, it just says an existing company. So that's a particularly important point. It's going to be used somewhere in the question later on, or in your answer. What else is important besides that in the question?
The date.
Yep. Why would the date be important? Sorry? I didn't realise that was April Fool's Day. I would have changed that. I didn't realise that was April Fool's Day. Oh, that's past. Yeah, so the date is important. Not that it's April Fool's Day. What else? The other important point is who are you? You're the appointed actuary. That's an important point. And it's an Australian life company, because in some context, whether it's an Australian life company or an overseas life company will be important. It's a Sunday. Yeah, it was a Sunday.
Yeah,
a bit rough, Jordan. Yeah, no, I didn't check my dates when I did that, sorry. Hopefully people won't check their calendars when they do that. Okay, the next two paragraphs basically set the scene more about the product. That may be important. So the thing you should register in this bit here is that these are basically simple products. So there'll usually be a description of the product, which will sometimes may be important in the question. But this instance, it's just a simple product. Okay. Now, the next bit is the next three paragraphs. What's important about the next? That thing where it says the financial year ends on 30 September and the next two paragraphs. I'll get you to read that and think about what's important in terms of those three paragraphs. Why are they in the question?
Indicate the purpose of the financial condition report.
what else is important? Why is this sentence here? Why is the examiner put this bit in here, that experience? Yeah. It also gives an indication of how you might respond. You want to take that into account when you're answering the question. What about this next one? This last paragraph. What's important about that? Why is that in there? It has to be in there for a reason. So what's the key thing you want to pick out of that? Any ideas? Yep.
Your team is reasonably inexperienced.
Yeah. So, looking at that, not without coming to the questions yet, you can see that there's certain key information that should trigger something. You might say, why is the examiner asked me to put this information in the question? It must be there for a reason, right? So that's why you've got to take into account that sort of information. Okay, if we then go to the questions. So I think you can just read that. We might just go through each question because it's probably the focus on each question that I want to look at, not the whole lot. Okay, so looking at question, when you look at that part A question, what should you do first? What do you look at? What do you look at in terms of how much time you should spend on the question, how long your answer should be?
Number of marks.
Yep. So what does it say in terms of number of marks for this question?
1 mark.
Okay. So how much time should you spend on it?
1 minute.
And how long should your answer be?
1 to 2 sentences.
Okay. So let's look at the sentence here. This is fairly basic and pretty standard. What are the key words in that sentence? So this is where you can go through and underline key words. So you're picking up certain things. So what are the key words here in that sentence?
The key.
Yeah. But it's the key responsibility, isn't it?
Yeah, because that just says implicitly there's only one.
Okay. Okay, but if you didn't read this question properly, you could read that as responsibilities, couldn't you? And think there's more than one, right? So that's why it's key to underline it, saying key responsibility. There's only one, right? What are the other key things you would underline here?
Describe.
Yeah, what else?
Difference.
Yeah, and what else? that's what I'm getting at, covering every word, basically. It's making sure, so what's the key thing? Who are you comparing? Yeah, so you could go through this, I know it's fairly standard basic, but you could underline describe, difference, key responsibility, appoint actuary and board of directors, right? So that's one way of doing it. So then, if I look, okay, now this actually comes from the chief examiner's report I wrote, so I'm just providing some feedback. So you can see it was a straightforward question. So you're right, most students knew they had to provide a brief answer in two concise sentences. But, okay, this is the issue about exam technique. Some students spent a full page writing all this stuff and meandered around the point and perhaps didn't get a mark. Right? So it's not really the right thing to spend a page. If you suddenly write a page on a one-mark question, then your exam technique is not all that good. And what this means is you're probably not hitting the point and you're probably reducing the amount of time you can spend on the other questions where you've got to get 99 more marks. So it's important you look at the marks in the question and how much time you should spend on it. That's an important thing. Okay, let's go back. How do we go back? Okay. now we go back. Okay, let's look at part B. So just read that first bit. So again, what's the importance? Why is that first paragraph in there in the first place? What is it doing? What is it stressing the importance of? But what is it also focusing on? Yeah? What is it also effectively saying in the last couple of words? Yeah. So that's what you should stick in your mind. So that's why that sentence is in there, because it sets the scene to focus on communication. Okay, what about the next sentence when it asks you to do things? What's the important thing here you should look at? In that, what's it asking you to do? Okay. So in terms of the marks, how many points do you think you need to mention?
Eight.
Yeah. So each one is about half a mark. So you've got to use some judgment about how many points are going to be allocated to the marks. So it's really focusing on communication. Okay, let's look at... Okay. Now, for a fairly straightforward question, does everyone think this is a straightforward question? Or perhaps it isn't. It wasn't very well answered. So what I've highlighted in sort of these last two is where poor exam tech is coming in. So essentially... people didn't mention other points that could have been included, like a contents page and an appendix for technical details. They didn't cover, they could have got more points if they mentioned some additional points. But the last one point is also critical. They did not read the question properly. They basically just wrote out a list of topics or headings of the FCR. Now, do you think, is that what was required by the question? What do you think? That's all they did. So, effectively what they did, they were perhaps thinking of a previous question and probably just listed the contents of the FCR. They might have got marks for that, for structure, well-organised structure, but that would have been half a mark. So they would have perhaps could have wasted a page getting half a mark for that. So that's not what the question was really asking. It was asking for more than that. It was asking how would you effectively communicate to the directors. So that's why it's important in this instance to read the question very carefully, perhaps twice. Just don't read the question once and jump on something that you think is asking. Think carefully about what the question is asking. Let's look about C. Okay, C, discuss the issue. Okay, so what's the important point of C when you're reading that? What things would you underline for question C, for part C? What do you need to do? Any suggestions?
Discuss the issues.
Yeah, that's one point. What's the other important part of it?
Resolving.
Yeah. So the important thing you should know that you've got to discuss issues and resolve them. So there's two paths to this question. But they're also saying for each issue, you need to come up with a resolution. So... in terms of the marks, what does the marks tell you about this question? How many points should you raise? How many? We've got different takers, different numbers. How many? I know it depends on the detail of the course, but it's seven, because basically it's saying half marks, half of those seven is probably for identifying the issues, and half a mark for... describing the resolution. So there's seven there. Okay.
Would you bother discussing the issues if you get half a
I think it's probably got the slight dip, in hindsight, it's probably got the wrong wording there. It should really say describe. But there's generally, it's two parts to that question.
A clue is that it's an odd number of marks and you've got yes. two things.
Okay, the other, you've got to also understand how the exam drafters draft this question. If it was an even number of marks, say there were 8 points, say I could think of 8 possible marks, I would split that into two parts. I would say discuss the issues, give 4 marks for that, and say how you would resolve them as a separate 4 marks. That's how the drafting, because I could only come up with 7. I couldn't show 3.5 marks in the exam, it doesn't look right. Well, that's how it's done. So when you see something like that, it's an odd number, which implies, in general, that each of them receive half a mark. So it's half a mark for each issue identified and half mark for each resolution in this instance. So you've got to understand, you've got to look at the marks and then try and use judgment to work out how many points you need to talk about in the question. So what's a good way to set out this in an exam paper? How would you set this out? When you've got to do 2 things, what's a good way of setting this out in the exam paper when you're writing the answer? Why is that a good idea or a bad idea?
It's easy to read.
Yeah. What also does it do?
It splits up what the issue is and what the resolution.
Yeah. You'll notice it in the slide, but what it does, it makes sure you've got that in that structure. It means for each issue, you can then see whether you've written down a resolution for it. Because if you do it the other way and write an issues in resolution, it's harder to mark for the examiner, but also there's a chance that you might miss that resolution by not relating to the issue. And you'll see that's how generally, well, the solutions are set out that way. But I haven't really seen students do things like that, but that's a very good idea because it helps the marker mark the exam paper. And anything that helps the marker makes him happier, the better it is. So let's just see. Okay. Now, you can see I've only got one thing in black. So you can see most people did badly on this question. What was the reason for this? Okay. So if you look at the first point, most people covered the obvious points. Okay. So remember that we talked about lack of knowledge or inexperienced actuarial staff? That's where that would come in. Now, that's fairly obvious, isn't it? Because it's giving you a hint in the question about that. If you don't state that, then you've sort of lost perhaps 1 mark straight away. So you've got to state the obvious. Read what's in the question and use it in your answer. Now, the second point is also the important point about the first paragraph. About many students, the problem is many students don't relate it back to the question. Again, they might forget the question and just apply some generic things. So they didn't relate it to the first year. So the first year had 1 or 2 points related to it. So if you noted that in the first paragraph and thought about it, you think that must be used in the answer somewhere. Yeah, so that's what I mentioned about structuring a certain way so you make sure you have a resolution for each issue. Now, this other point is a generally generic issue. People will talk about data risk and model risk, but the examiner isn't really sure that they really understand the question because they haven't related to the question. So you need to say why model risk is important because perhaps it's the first time you've done evaluation, so you've got to make sure your data you're getting from the administration system is correct and your models are right because you're using it for the first time. You've got to explain. Well, you can't just say model risk. You've got to say why it's important. So that's what I mean by a clear and full explanation and why it's important. Yeah, so the second last point is getting those extra points that students probably didn't get about administration system expense apportionment. Now, a way to cover that, this may not work in all the situations, but if you think about an FCR, there's a whole list of contents you've got to cover. If you had this as a checklist or even your summary at the exam, you could go through and say, okay, is that an issue in this instance? This is a good way of picking up points you would not normally think of straight away. So checklists may help in certain situations, and that's where a summary might help in the exam. You can go through these points and say, is this an issue? There's more likelihood you're going to come up with more points that way. So checklists can work in some circumstances. And the last point was no one mentioned about the conflict of interest. So this is generally a general point that people didn't cover that last point. We then go to... We'll just jump to D, I think. Let's jump to D. So let's look again at part D. What does the marks in the question give you hint as? We've covered this before.
Odd number, so there's going to be half the first, the I and half the double
I. That's because we couldn't think of an even number of marks. And we needed some marks to get the total 100. That's how it works. That's how we set up being met. Marking guy, oh, we need five. I need an extra mark here, so what am I going to put? I'll leave it odd, but I won't tell them how many marks specifically for that part one or part two. Okay, so how many points should you raise here? How many do you think you need to raise?
Five.
Yeah. Half a mark for possible reasons and half a mark for saying why it's critical. Yeah, so in general, this question is, most people covered the basic points, that capital adequacy, target surplus. A few candidates mentioned solvency. And the important last point again was, people didn't think about the first year of operation. What does it mean if it's in the first year of operation? They may might be making a loss, so they can't pay a dividend. And there's no retained earnings, so how can you pay a dividend or retained earnings if it doesn't exist? So this again is sort of addressing the question. The information in the question. So the next one. Okay, and this was fairly well answered in this question. So how many points do you think you need to raise for part E? You've got to know the context of the question, so. Effectively, there was 2 points required, basically. And most students got that. Any questions so far? Okay, now some suggestions. We are plugging the online form today. Did I read your slides? Oh, yes, I did. The online form, you shouldn't just do the minimum. You need to basically round out your knowledge. Those things you find difficult and don't quite understand. Those things that are nagging at you, those little things. Ask it now, otherwise it's too late. You can always use the online form to ask that question. Now, you need to practice the exam questions, past exam questions, the more the better. It's very important to practice. Now, it's important, what I suggest is you need to think like an examiner. So what I'm suggesting, in study groups, you mark someone else's exam paper or just one question. This is important because I think you'll learn a lot by putting yourself in the examiner's shoes, because then you'll say to yourself, you need to provide constructive feedback. Don't provide negative feedback. Provide constructive feedback, because the person will also provide feedback on your answer. So you have to ask your basic questions we showed on that first slide about this one. So when you're marking someone else's paper, ask yourself, well, this is what you've got to do as an examiner when you're marking the paper. Has the person answered the question properly? Have they read the question? Have they stated the obvious point? Can you read their writing? This is an important slide you need to look at in terms of saying to yourself, when you're looking at someone's exam, have they covered this and have they got these weaknesses and do they need to improve on these weaknesses? So if you've got 2 weeks to go for the exam, this is what you could perhaps focus on, because a little extra marks here and there can help you get over that borderline into a pass. So that's what I suggest you focus on. So that's a wrap up on my part. Any questions? General questions? Do you want to add anything, Bruce?
One thing that came up both in Gary's point and mine was about MCRs. Put your hand up, please, if you have actually seen an old, a real MCR. Way less than half of you. If you're doing the life course or the general course, I'd suggest you get hold of one. If you don't work in a life company or a general company, then you're in a bit of trouble. Maybe find somebody who was appointed actuary of a company 10 years ago and might be willing to show you something from 10 years ago that's not got topical and private things in it. But did you see from Gary's point there were some obvious things like a table of contents, right? It's not in the Institute's table of what you put in an FCR, but a table of contents you will find in every real FCR. Can't get hold of a real one.
So you shouldn't be afraid to ask the appointed actuary to go through the FCR and look at one. You need to put yourself out there to get the information. Because if you work in a life company, there's plenty of experts in that company that you shouldn't be afraid to ask. So if you don't work in an evaluation team, you should ask them, what's the important things when you do analysis of profit? What are the critical things that you should look at when you do analysis of profit? So you've got plenty of opportunities. If you're not working in a big company, you can always perhaps ask people to join a study group, and then you can get the advice of other students in bigger companies. So there's various things you can do, but you've got to put yourself out there. You've got to do the work and put yourself out there to do the extra work. You can't just rely on the contents of the course. So any other general questions? This is your chance. Because this isn't a critical topic. This is why a lot of students fail. They know their stuff, but they exhibited one of these failings, one or all of these failings. So I'm suggesting you need to tackle this specifically, perhaps in your remaining 2 weeks. It might be good use of your time.
Could you make these slides available to us?
Yeah, they'll be all made available.
Thanks.
So, does anyone in the audience have any suggestions in terms of what they do in the exam that works well for them? Or good study techniques that they do, preparation for the exam, that might help other people here?
Can I just ask you one more question? In terms of like, how do you decide like number of points you needed for a particular question? Because I find like in the example you give it to us, say if we have a 7-mark question, we want to have 7 points. Is it generally like 1 point for 1 mark?
It's no golden rule. Bruce might have some idea, but generally, if it's a hard question, like a complex judgment question, you usually find it's probably 1 mark per question per point. But it might be half a mark for a minor little point. For something that's not as hard, but perhaps more simple judgment, it might be half a mark, but it depends on the circumstance. Can I really do this by practice, probably? By looking at past exam questions, I don't know what you've got in your ears.
A couple of years ago, there was an exam that had quarter marks allocated. That did not work well. The students or for the markers, and it won't happen again. Part of the answer has got to be, if you know the material and you've got an idea, is there likely to be 3 or 4 issues here that I can mention, or is there likely to be 7 or 8 issues? Right? And because you know that, you can say, aha, they're giving me 8 marks here, and they've used a word like describe, right? Not a word like list. And so it sounds as though I need to describe 4 things reasonably fully, and there's 2 marks here because I really think that there's only 4. Or dare I say, I know the course pretty well, I can only think of 3, there's probably 4. All right? So I'm going to earn 2 marks for each of my 3. right, and accept and leave some space and hopefully come back and get prompted by a later part of the question. There's something I forgot for an earlier part, go back and fill that in. When we go through specific examples like this, the assumption is that you know it all.
Yeah.
And that having used the appropriate techniques, you will come up with an answer that's worth 90% of the marks. Now, that's not actually very likely. Not that it is, not in this room. Right? More likely is that you are travelling around about pass mark, right? You've got 50% of my knowledge. Now you've got to use technique to build yourself from 50% up to that 60% that you need to pass. The technique that Gary described, you know, there were plurals in there, you know, the issues. Ah, there's more than one.
So it's quite easy to read that as an issue, not issues.
Yeah, right? And to use that nitpicking technique on every word. You're not underlining words to use pens up. You're underlining words to make sure that you pick up what's important about them. And when it says issues, and it's two marks for the thing, well, okay, there's obviously two issues. And you've got to come up with two issues.
So that's why it's important when I stress, I know it was fairly basic, simple, I said key responsibility, not responsibilities. I know it's fairly basic and obvious, but it's a common thing that people fall into by not reading the question. So you need to apply some technique to make sure you overcome these weaknesses in reading a question. So this can come through practice. You might help, if you work in study groups, you can do this together by looking at the exam question, not perhaps initially under exam conditions, but you can say to yourself, how should we tackle this question? And you can also at the same time perhaps brainstorm things that you may not think of but other people in the study group might come up with. So that's one way of doing it.
My attempts earlier to talk about communication when it's not your strength, when you're a mathematician rather than a communicator. Again, take on board what Gary's saying. A plural or a singular is important. Sad, isn't it? But hey, see how it's important? See how you can get some clues. Is there an odd number of marks for the question or an even number?
So what I'm saying, you put yourself, that's why I say it's important to put yourself in terms of the exam mark itself. And look how you would write the question. Why is the question written like that? It's in there for a reason. So if you look back at that thing, it said how that actuarial stuff was inexperienced got in there. I'll explain why. The trick of this was that there wasn't enough needed extra marks for the question. Points. So how am I going to get extra points in that? Or perhaps I'll put something about inexperienced staff as a solution. But if I put that in there, I've got to give some hint in the question. Because it would be fair, you can't leave that out, because no student would get it. So it's in there for a reason. Because you've got to mention it in the question. So there's hints in the question. And they're fairly obvious ones sometimes.
Emphasizes a point that Kerry contributed early when Gary was saying, how many times do you read the question? The answer's got to be at least three. And my process would be something like, skim the question and see what it's about. Right? You turn the page and see how long it is, how many marks it is in total. Right? Okay, this is a question about such and such. Right? And go and read the question, underlining the keywords, etc., etc. But the third time is somewhere when you're two-thirds of the way through your answer, you refer back and make sure that each part of the question has been covered off. There's a clue there. Aha, I've forgotten about that one. I need to put that in part three to hear my answer. So you're going to read the question at least three times.
And point form is usually good, but make sure they're full sentences. The best one I've seen is a bullet point with an explanation, then a blank line. It's very easy for someone, a marker, to read that and mark it.
Anyone play in five?
So do you think you could use any of these? Do you think you would do anything differently now in the next couple of weeks to identify some of the issues, assuming you know all the stuff?
right. How about a round of applause for both Gary and Bruce for their time today? And the only thing left to say is we wish you all the best in your upcoming exams. Good luck, everyone. Thanks for coming.
I might just go to the bathroom.